I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Join late-night legend Jon Stewart and the best news team for today's biggest headlines, exclusive extended interviews, and more. Now this is a second term we can all get behind. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome to Invention. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And Robert, I don't know if you've ever had this experience. Have you ever been out walking in nature and you decided to veer off the path for some reason? Maybe you saw something interesting way off there in the distance. You wanted to go check it out, only to immediately discover to your own humiliation how difficult it is to walk through uncleared terrain.
Oh, yeah. I've definitely had this experience before. And that's not even getting into, issues of ticks and other parasites.
Ooh, yeah. There's the tick problem, definitely. But unless you're somebody with a particular class of outdoor hobbies or lines of work, you would probably be so embarrassed to realize how much of your life you spend on pre-selected traversable pathways, like the floor of your house or workplace, the sidewalk to the door, the sidewalk down the road itself. Even when you go out in nature, it's really likely that you probably spend most of your time out there following some kind of forged or trodden pathway. And if you get off the path, planet Earth almost immediately transforms into this unruly and difficult place with uneven footing and branches and rocks and vegetation blocking your path, sudden drop-offs, steep inclines. This is Earth, and this is what a large part of the surface of planet Earth is like, and much of it is just not made to be quickly and easily traveled over. It's funny how even if you go out and spend a decent amount of time in nature, you can mostly overlook this fact just by staying on the path. So that's what we wanted to look at today, something we don't often even think of as a human invention, but in a way certainly is the roads we travel.
That's right. It's really an essential part of the world that we have created.
Yeah.
However, if we want to understand the human history of roads and even get into the pre-human history of roads, we have to acknowledge the work of our non-human relatives, the work of animals, because we do have animal paths to consider. The trails left by, say, deer in the forest, the buffalo roads across the western plains of North America, animals on the move from one area to another had to push aside vegetation, and in the act of moving, they end up trampling down the earth beneath their weight. And we're talking about a lot of weight when we're considering wide-ranging megafauna, some of which we still have today, but we had even more of in prehistoric times.
Yeah, I guess before there were the cattle roads, we had the Oryx roads or something.
Yeah. And of course, when other animals came along in their wake, these paths were there, and they often represented the swiftest, least obstructed way to get from one place to another.
Yeah, it's certainly interesting to think about animal trails as being a type of geomodification or adaptation of the landscape itself to the organism. Now, a lot of the ways that organisms survive are by adapting to the landscape around them, but sometimes they survive by changing the landscape to better suit them, and they don't necessarily do this consciously. It's just their activities bring this about. The big examples are things like beaver dams.
Yeah, beaver dams is just altering the immediate environment, or even looking to megafauna that such as an elephant that may push down trees and other vegetation.
Yeah, but of course we can see paths emerging that in some ways play some of the same roles.
Yeah. Now, I do want to drive home here, though, that even though animal trails are often brought up as being sort of the pre-human origin of roads and human pathways, and certainly seem to play a role in them, there are some who take issue with giving animal trails too much importance, arguing that, well, animals don't actually follow consistent paths all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a definite connection here, but it is one that is pointed out in a lot of the literature. And speaking of the literature, one of the books that we look to for this episode is a book by the title of Ways of the World, A History of the World's Roads and of the Vehicles That Used Them by Maxwell Gordon Lay, an Australian civil engineer.
Published in 1992.
In the book, Lay says that, you know, on this whole issue of animal paths, it really depends on the environment. He says, quote, difficult terrain or dense vegetation in fertile areas would certainly have required narrow and specific animal ways. So even if, yeah, you can say that, you know, animals aren't going to always follow consistent paths, there are going to be environments where there is like one best way to get from point A to point B, if point A to point B is indeed a path that needs to be navigated by animals.
One way to see an analogy here is if you ever look at the desire paths that form along a college campus or a courtyard of a well-populated building or something. Do you ever see these at college, Robert, where there would be like paved pathways but then branching off in a shortcut between two places, there would be a place where the grass was just beaten down and there was dusty dirt?
Oh, yeah. It's kind of a breakdown in planning because like clearly you did not plan out the best paved route for foot traffic. Clearly, foot traffic wants to go this way.
But it's kind of beautiful watching those things emerge because nobody planned it that way, just as you're saying. Even the students didn't plan it that way. Just over time, enough people make the same decision about where to go and how to get there that these natural pathways emerge.
Yeah, until someone throws up a hedge or something.
Yeah.
So eventually you have a few species of hominids that come along and they distinguish themselves in intelligence. And they start forging their own trails, often incorporating animal trails whenever it makes sense as well. So yeah, if the trail of the megafauna is there, they may use it, but they may also beat down their own paths as well. So, you know, they would have navigated, by doing this, they would have navigated difficult terrain, bodies of water. And prior to the coming of Europeans to the Americas, the native peoples here, they had their own complex system of foot trails by which they could travel the land. In his book, Lay points out the Natchez Trace, a 440-mile or 710-kilometer trail that goes from Natchez, Mississippi to Nashville, Tennessee, and it was used by native peoples for centuries. And it was said to have been originally created by buffalo heading north to salt licks in the area of what is now Nashville, Tennessee.
Yeah, and this highlights something you might not immediately think about with roads because roads not only allow you to move more easily by providing a clear path and a surface that's easy to walk on, they also help you know where you're going. And this could even be the case for animals, right? Many animals have inbuilt navigation capabilities that others don't. As a large bipedal primate, just try to find your way around in the world without a compass or a map or a road. You're probably going to have kind of a hard time of it. And you can also consider the fact that even if you're not following a familiar road to get somewhere specific, you can follow any road to eventually get somewhere significant. Like, people don't usually build roads to nowhere, and that applies to animals as well.
Now, in considering lands that have known the influence of humans for far longer than the Americas, it has also been theorized that some of the older winding roads in places like England have their roots in wild animal pathways leading to fords and watering holes. And of course, in the case of many of these ancient trails, they might remain somewhat fluid for a number of reasons, because you have shifting waterways, trees are going to fall, beavers are going to do their thing, storms are going to add chaos as the scenario. So any number of things might occur that alter the shape of the path. And of course, additional changes would come as humans continue to develop their primitive technologies, right? They require more paths for their own meager footfalls. The cultivation of crops and animal husbandry would have increasingly created a world where certain areas had to remain off limits to animals, particularly to domesticated animals, mm-hmm. and other zones roads would need to easily and safely convey these creatures from one place to another. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we are going to continue along the road. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh, my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And, of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics, in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
All right, we're back. Now, obviously, there is no single inventor of Rhodes, so we can't point to Dr. Rhodulus, who came up with Rhodes 10,000 years ago. Didn't happen.
Sir Walter Rhodes. We've already discussed how the footpaths of early humans likely made use of animal paths to some degree. But then what happens, again, when humans transition out of their mere hunter-gatherer lifestyle? What happens in the wake of the agricultural revolution, resulting in such innovations as domesticated animals? And then eventually, wheel and sledge constructions for dragging surplus crops, firewood, and other necessities around.
Now, once you introduce the idea of wheeled vehicles, things change significantly, and it's worth noting as an aside that the strange and fascinating fact that it appears the wheel was not invented for transportation until sometime around the 4th millennium BCE, like 3500 BCE or something, which at first exposure to this fact seems shockingly late, right?
Yeah.
Grain agriculture has probably existed since around 9 to 10,000 BCE, which means that roughly half the time humans have been farming, nobody had wheeled vehicles to move sacks of grain or whatever around. So, of course, maybe we shouldn't be surprised given that wheels are a deeply unnatural invention, right? So many human inventions have some kind of analogy in nature. While there are animals that roll their bodies or parts of their bodies in various ways, maybe the closest is the bacterial flagella, which nobody could have seen in antiquity.
Right, they didn't have the microscope to see some of the more wheel-like creatures in the animal kingdom.
But even that's not really a wheel. There's just nothing in nature that operates on a wheel and axle, and we should definitely revisit the invention of the wheel.
Oh,
yes. In the future.
That's a no-brainer. We have to come back to that.
But so, yeah, think about this. Just thousands of years of agriculture and road, in some way, road-based transport, at least some primitive forms of roads, without wheeled vehicles on them.
Yeah. Now, on the subject of domesticated herd, you might well require a dependable road to connect winter and summer grazing lands. And indeed, we see examples of this in the Canadas Reales in Spain. These are drover's roads covering some 125,000 kilometers. Another example are the Welsh roads of England that linked Scotland and Wales to London markets. Again, just moving domesticated animals from one place to another.
Yeah, roads are necessary for the development of trade. And in many ways, you could say for the development of culture. I mean, almost everything that we think of in culture comes ultimately from the connections of peoples to each other, you know, the meeting of different minds across distance. And that's all enabled by roads and trade.
Yeah, and even though a lot of these, you know, roads change over time, obviously, and you don't find a lot of paths that remain in use for just extended periods of time. But you do see these wonderful examples of some of these pathways, particularly in North America and Britain, where just they have centuries of wear and tear, and they've essentially become little trenches just from all of the foot traffic. And that is pretty amazing.
Yeah, though the Roman roads were dug out to begin with, I believe, or at least some of them were, right? Like they would dig down a trench in a way to become the road.
Oh, yeah. And that's where we're getting in really into the serious construction of roads. And ultimately, that's what we need to talk about at this point is when you start constructing a road, it's not merely, well, we sure did move those goats from here to there enough times that there's a best way to do that. No, what happens when we get into the idea of planning a road, manufacturing it, reinforcing it, caring and maintaining it? When we start asking that question, well, Lay says that, quote, the creation of major lowland ways required a degree of engineering skill and organization that began to develop around 4000 BCE. He points out that the oldest British, quote, planned and engineered pathways date back to Glastonbury, UK, 33,000 BCE. And good local roads ultimately helped the Britons defeat the Roman legions in 55 BCE.
Now, of course, on the other hand, extensive high-quality roads are a major factor in the military success of the Roman Republic and then the Roman Empire.
Right, or really any particular empire. I think back to episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind that you and I did on the Inca,
yeah,
and the importance of the Inca road system, which also incorporated tremendously impressive rope bridges,
yeah,
and how that contributed to the success of the Inca.
Yeah, a great part of the power of the Inca Empire lay in its transportation and communication infrastructure.
Yeah, and if you want to quickly convey your troops from one point in an empire or a kingdom to another, especially across difficult terrain in order to defend or expand a kingdom, you're going to need good roads. And indeed, we see this reflected even in recent history. Say the United States interstate system. In the early 20th century, it was considered necessary for national defense.
Yeah, definitely. And there are multiple reasons that roads are necessary for military purposes. I mean, one, of course, is to get your armies to places. That's mm-hmm. the obvious one. But the other one is the thing that a lot of times people, you know, when you're playing your historical military games, like the, ooh, would Julius Caesar's army defeat the Mongols or mm-hmm. something like that? You know, you're doing all that stuff. People like to think about commanders and weapons and fighting styles and all that, but they don't think enough about the real thing that makes or breaks a war campaign, which is supply lines.
Right.
The ultimate gremlin of military history.
The army marches on its belly, right?
Yeah, an undersupplied army can't fight at full strength. And so the supply lines, how you get food and other major supplies to your troops, how you bring reinforcements to the front. I guess that all falls under the military category of logistics, but that's a huge part of the success of a military campaign.
Now, it's easy for us to get caught up in the, you know, these sort of country roads. We've been talking a lot about a lot of cross-country paths and roads. But as Lay points out in his book, you know, going back to ancient times, you see roads as a necessity of city planning. As cities become a thing, for human beings, it becomes necessary to think about how people are moving around in them, what sort of streets or roads are present. And you see this in the work of the ancient Egyptians and various Middle and Near Eastern civilizations. The use of roads in city plannings was discussed in the writings of, for instance, Greek city planner Hippodamus, and later referenced in the works of Aristotle and others. And sometimes city plans were based more on engineering, and other times there was some element of mysticism as well, which seems like it would be highly susceptible to mysticism, the construction of roads, because it is this kind of complex like system of unlanguage that you're laying out across the world.
Roads appear in all kinds of myths and legends and religiously significant stories.
Oh,
the
yeah.
road to Damascus, the road to Emmaus, the Little Red Riding Hood on the road to her grandmother's house.
Yeah, how many horror stories throughout history are essentially stories about what happens when you go off of the path or the road, right?
Right, yeah. Mirkwood and The Hobbit.
Yeah. If they stick to the road, gentlemen, and you're not going to encounter problems, don't go chasing elf lights into the dark. Now, of course, we'd be remiss if we didn't mention one of the great roads, the Silk Road, an example of roads running into other roads to become more or less a single pathway, dating back to roughly 300 BCE, connecting various caravan routes across Eurasia.
One of the all-time greats.
All-time
great
Silk
roads. Road.
Yeah, top five, top three, to be sure.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, but we will be right back.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh, my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And, of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Wow, thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics, in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
All right, we're back.
Okay, now one thing that certainly changes about roads over time is that the original roads were just beaten down areas of Earth, right? They're mm-hmm. where the cattle or the large bovids or whatever would push through. They'd trample down the ground and make it flat, and they'd push the vegetation aside so there'd be a clear pathway going somewhere. But over time, roads took on a more technological character. People were looking for better ways to make more reliable roads, because you got a road like that that's maybe just some trampled down, cleared earth. Maybe let's say you have some heavy rains. What you tend to find is that the road like that gets a little bit washed out and erodes.
Yeah, I mean, in our own neighborhoods here in Atlanta, we have at least a few examples of this, where you have an unofficial pathway. Mm-hmm. And then what happens when it becomes a muddy wreck? And then you see some very amateur, essentially, road building, where people are like, well, I'll just dump a bunch of rocks in here, or I have some tire garbage. That'll really help things out.
Yes, and I will fix the path with a whole bunch of cans or something.
Yeah. And it essentially, this is kind of what we see in some of the early corduroy roads or log roads that are created to deal with muddy terrain.
They're better than cans.
But essentially, we're talking about placing logs perpendicular to the direction of the road. And examples of this sort of road date back at least 4,000 years. There's the so-called post track in Somerset Levels, England, for instance. And it makes sense, right? Like, what do you do if your vehicle is stuck in the mud, right?
just grind and grind in the mud until you're buried.
You get some sticks or logs, you know, whatever pieces of wood, and you put them under the tire.
Yeah,
you want something to pull up on.
Some traction. Yeah. You want to put something under the tire that will stay where it is when you're driving.
Yeah. So that is essentially what the post track is. Lay mentions another one. He says the sweet track uses longitudinal logs to support oblique crossed pegs, which form a V. Every meter or so. Planks between the Vs create a walking path.
Hmm.
And this is the sweep path from near Glastonbury, which dates back to 3,300 BCE.
Now, Robert, when did people first come up with the idea of the old popper, the gravel road?
I was thinking about this, and I was reading around in Lay's book and looking at a couple other sources on this, and yeah, it's one of these things that feels like it should be pretty archaic. Because again, we come back to that idea, what do you do when the path gets muddy? Well, one solution is get some rocks and throw them on there, right?
Right, yeah.
And that clearly seems to have been something that would have been utilized by our ancient ancestors. But when you start really thinking about gravel roads, it gets pretty interesting. We can really take the technology and the labor involved for granted.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I was recently in Costa Rica.
Okay.
And we went up to Monteverde in the cloud forests. And to get to Monteverde, you have to take this winding road. And more and more of it is paved now, but there's still a stretch that is gravel. And these are good gravel roads. I don't want to cast any unnecessary shade on the roads of Costa Rica because we never felt in danger or anything. You know, these are nice gravel roads.
I've been on some scary gravel roads in Georgia.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, and if I'm being honest, like gravel roads in general, like tend to wig me out, but probably unnecessarily so. But yeah, think about what essentially a gravel road is. Instead of lining the road with wood, you cover it with dirt or rocks or gravel taken from, in today's cases, some sort of quarried area, right? But more likely in older examples, you'd be talking about rocks from a creek bed. The problem, of course, is that gravel can be washed away, and then you have this huge task of hauling it, all the gravel back up, and then distributing it where it needs to go, and this can be quite intensive. I mean, just look at modern cases. If you see any kind of maintenance going on, or if you happen to get to see the creation of a gravel road, you're going to see the hauling and distribution via massive pieces of equipment, dump trucks and what have you. And perhaps this is a major reason you tend to see more widespread use of gravel roads in, say, early 20th century U.S. and 20th century developing areas and nations as well, because it simply becomes cheaper to transport and dump all the necessary gravel, which is, of course, again, now mined and transported on dependable roadways rather than just laboriously transported from stream beds to, roadways that might be questionable in their own right.
Yeah, the age of the dump truck made it possible.
Yeah. So think about that the next time you're on a gravel road. Realize that this is perhaps more of a modern conveyance than you're giving it credit for. Now, of course, when we talk about like the best, the most modern examples of a road, you're going to think of paved roads, right? These are the gold standard.
I thought you were going to say a rainbow road.
No, but I guess a rainbow road would probably be paved as well because a gravel rainbow road would just become distorted from all of the traffic. That would be really difficult to maintain. And yet, here's the thing. As modern as these feel, even though this feels like the height of modernity, these actually go back quite a long ways in human history as well.
Uh-huh.
So you have stone-paved roads that date back to, for instance, the Middle Eastern city of Ur, circa 4,000 BCE. You have brick-paved roads in India that date back to 3,000 BCE. And we also see them in Malta from around 2,000 to 1,500 BCE. Basically, as humans developed and improved the ability to cut stones and mix mortar, they crafted not only walls but roads. Because ultimately, what is a road but a kind of wall that is laid on the ground, right? The technology is not all that different.
Yeah, okay. But then there was also, the development of what would you call it? The supporting infrastructure around the road. If you look at, say, some of the stone-paved Roman roads, you'll see that they not only had this paved surface, but they had protective elements like They had like retaining walls or ditches, you know, to get the right kind of drainage or protection from the road against the elements.
Oh, yeah. Drainage is key, and waterproofing. And this leads us to the bitumen roads, which are pretty interesting page from the history of road technology. First, just a reminder on what bitumen is.
It's the word I can never remember how to pronounce the American way. I think we say it the British way, which is bitumen.
Yeah, it's a mouthful, but it's also arguably the world's first petroleum product. It's a sticky black viscous substance, and when it's combined with mixed with sand and stone, you get essentially asphalt. But it was highly prized in the ancient world, and for the longest, it was primarily a Mesopotamian monopoly, and it saw use in various endeavors, everything from art and cosmetics to just caulking your boat.
Didn't we talk about it on an episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind as a potential constituent of Greek fire?
We did, yes. And it also came up in an older episode on mummies. Actually, the word mummy is linked to the word bitumen. And then, of course, physicians in the region eventually used it to treat a number of ailments. But by 3000 BCE, it was used in mortar, among other things. And by 2500, it was used in waterproofing. And it was later used in roads along with burnt bricks. And around 615 BCE, King Nebuchadnezzar and his father, Nabopolassar, mentioned its use in streets paved for the procession of the great god Marduk.
Oh, nothing less for the feet of Marduk.
Yeah. But then this brings us back to the Roman roads, which we've already been touching on, because the Roman roads are generally considered the peak of road making in the ancient world. Though one shouldn't dismiss the road making prowess of, say, the Persians and the Chinese before them, mm-hmm. but still, this was an empire like famous for their roads. We have the saying, all roads lead to Rome for a reason. Now, as Lay points out, Rome was, of course, an empire, and empires have a way of taking certain things, either culturally or technologically, from others, either those who have come before or those who are brought in to the empire, right? So they made use of Greek lime cement and masonry, Etruscan cement, Carthaginian pavement, and Egyptian surveying. They famously utilized lime-based concrete as early as 509 BCE. And what's crazy is that after the Roman Empire collapsed around 400 CE, concrete construction basically disappeared from Europe, and it didn't pop up again until roughly 1754. And that's when a gentleman by the name of William Smeaton, founder of civil engineering in England, developed a mortar of limestone and clay that hardened underwater. All right, so we've kind of breezed through the history of roads here. Again, Lay has a whole book on this, and it's a great read, so I recommend anyone check that out if you want a deeper dive. But this brings us to the legacy of roads. It's really difficult to think about our world without roads in them, because roads just crisscross everything. They can truly be seen from space. Even a few Roman roads, and especially some desert highways, really stand out against the surrounding environment.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting how often roads and pathways have remained the same for so long, or remained close to the same. It's one of the bridges between the technological civil infrastructure of the ancient world and the modern world.
Yeah,
the way in Europe you still find so many of the Roman roads basically in use.
Now, of course, one of the things about roads remaining in use is that you either have to build new roads over the old roads, or you have to just maintain the roads you have, essentially continuously rebuilding them piece by piece in kind of a Ship of Theseus manner, I suppose. And along these lines, Scott Benjamin, who does some research for this show, he pointed us in the direction of a Midwest blog post titled "How Much Does It Cost to Build a Mile of Road?" with some interesting stats in it.
Yeah, this is something I'd never really considered before.
Yeah, because we see road maintenance going on all the time, and generally our main reaction is, "Oh, this is annoying. Yeah. This is slowing me down.
Get out of my way."
So just consider these stats. These regard building the road. Forging a new road, okay? To build a new two-lane undivided road in a rural area costs between $2 and $3 million per mile. And
wow.
In urban areas, that's going to go up to $3 and $5 million, because you're going to have to deal with – because of all the stuff you're going to have to go around, all the infrastructure you're going to have to deal with, et cetera.
Yeah.
Four-lane highway, you're talking about between $4 and $6 million in rural areas, and in suburban areas between $8 and $10 million, again, per mile. The U.S. currently has somewhere in the neighborhood of 61 million lane miles, And to mill and resurface a four-lane road, it cost an average of $1.25 million per mile. And if you're looking to do a 4 to 6 lane expansion on top of that, $4 million.
Sounds like we need to get into the road business.
Well, in a way, it's a great business to be in, I guess, because the roads are everywhere.
Yeah.
Even the best roads are continually falling apart because they're weathered by all of these forces we've discussed, plus the intense traffic traveling atop it.
We're going to keep needing them.
Yeah. And we also keep coming up with new twists on the concept. Now, one of my favorite concepts regarding the future of roads is certainly a lofty one, but one that is attractive in many ways. And it is the idea of an underground automated highway, or UAH.
Oh, like a subway?
Essentially, it's like the idea is we've kind of corrupted the world. We've mm-hmm. divided up the natural world with all of these roads, and anytime animals try and cross it, they die, and it's breaking up forests, et cetera. But what if we were able to put all of those roads underground, or in some cases, you know, build some sort of green structure over it, and the animals could crawl over that, the vegetation could grow atop of it, and there would be all of these environmental benefits as well.
Yeah.
What if we had this kind of world, and then on top of that, the cars are going to drive themselves as well.
So imagine like those wildlife bridges, but it's not a bridge. It covers the entire road.
Exactly, yeah. Just what if we just had nothing but wildlife bridges? And it is kind of a beautiful concept. And there have been some lovely illustrations depicting what this kind of world would look like. And they do kind of line up with a lot of these, you know, very ambitious and optimistic visions for what the future of, say, certainly like middle America, I guess, would look like. You could also certainly put the roads underneath cities. Like everything becomes the subway in an urban environment.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I haven't looked recently to see what even the most optimistic time frame is for this sort of thing, but it's a lovely technological dream, if nothing else.
Oh, yeah. I mean, to imagine cities where all of the surface space is for pedestrians or is green space.
Yeah. Like, it's not even for pedestrian humans. It's for pedestrian deer and
kangaroos.
And megafauna. Let's bring them back, too.
And released crocodiles.
Yeah.
No, seriously, I do like that.
But until we get to that point, we are stuck with the roads we have, which are pretty impressive technological feats.
Yeah.
All right, so that's it for this week's episode of Invention. If you want to learn more about the show and check out other episodes, head on over to our website, inventionpod.com.
Big thanks to Scott Benjamin for research assistance with this episode. Thanks to our audio producer, Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us directly with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hi, let us know how you found out about the show, where you listen from, all that kind of stuff, you can email us at contact@inventionpod.com. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Join late night legend Jon Stewart and the best news team for today's biggest headlines, exclusive extended interviews, and more. Now this is a second term we can all get behind. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.